Turn your radio on.
This is a download from Triple J.
Australia's national youth network. On radio.
On TV.
And online.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture.
TripleJ.net.au.
And now...
Dr. Carl's joining us as he does every Thursday here at Triple J. Hello, Dr. Carl.
Hi there, Dr. Tam.
Hello. And if anybody wants to give us a call, that's how you do this science talkback thing. 1-300-055-36 if you've got a question for Dr. Carl. If you've got an answer and you're having trouble getting through, you can get through a couple of other ways. Tweet your answer if you're on Twitter to Dr. Carl. That's DocTorKarl. Or you can hit us up on the forum at triplej.net.au. Anything big happening in the world of science this week, Dr. Carl?
Well, we're gradually working out how to make planets.
How to make planets?
Yeah. Well, astronomy's been going through an evolution and changing. It's gone from Galileo. Well, it had naked eye astronomy, then working through looking at the planets in closer detail, and then working your way up through the stars, the nebulae, the galaxies, the universe, and now back to the exoplanets again. And we're beginning to understand what's going on. And I reckon that, look, there's a revolution happening in science. Astronomy bothers the heck out of me. It smells to me like ordinary astronomy did about a century ago, not that I was around then, but reading, they had this problem back then that the sun, they couldn't explain how the sun was burning, you know, weighing, even if it was made of coal, it's got a huge amount of energy, it would have burned out in a few million years, and yet the Earth, according to the geologists, was a lot older, and they solved that problem with radioactivity and quantum physics, which gives us the phone and all that sort of stuff. And now we've got this problem today that about 95% of the universe is missing, about 70% is this dark energy that's making the galaxies move away from each other more quickly, and about 20-something percent is the actual galaxies themselves are surrounded by this halo of invisible matter that is not made of neutrons and protons and regular stuff. Only about 4% of the whole universe is made up of regular matter like we know about, and there's just this big discovery over the horizon. Anywhere in the next hour to the next 20 years we'll have it, and then that will give us the next great breakthrough, and then we might have faster light travel. Oh, well, that's too much to ask for. But anyway, so that's a slow-moving one.
Okay.
Oh, and the Large Hadron Collider is about to come online. I'm so excited.
When you say about to, like in the next week?
Next week, month or so, it's gradually warming up. They've gone halfway around the ring, just checking it out. Now, oh, I'm so excited. That'll get us to the stars, but that's another topic for another time.
Okay. We had, while the news was on, also a question from Gary from the entrance. He couldn't stay on the line, but he did hear during the Triple J news a reference to dry lightning. What is dry lightning, Dr. Carl?
Dry lightning is when the lightning happens, but the storm cloud that's causing the rain is somewhere else, or the storm cloud has got updrafts so that as the rain falls, it gets pushed up, falls again, gets pushed up and lands somewhere else, either as really big raindrops or as hail. And there's a classic case of a United States Air Force base that had a small cloud way on the horizon, you know, like 15, 20 kilometres away, they reckon it was afterwards. And they were refueling an aeroplane on the runway, and a bolt of lightning came out of this small cloud way over on the horizon, hit the plane, and bad things happened and people got burnt and stuff like that. So dry lightning is just when there's no rain falling out of the sky at that particular moment.
Wow. Okay. Let's get into some talkback. 1-300-055-36. Luke from Wollongong is our first caller. Hi, Luke. Luke,
hi,
are you there?
Luke, come on down.
Luke, can you hear me?
Luke, we love
Luke's
you.
Gone.
Come
Luke
back.
Had a pretty good question about a fart too, but hopefully he'll call back.
Oh, I can answer that one.
Tim in Ballin, hello.
Hello, Tim.
How's it going, guys?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I was working today and I experienced a bit of deja vu. I just wonder if there's a scientific explanation or it's just one of those things that just happened.
Good question. We haven't heard this one in a while. What is déjà vu? What's the reasoning behind déjà vu, Dr. Carl?
Okay, well, let me start off when you said a very clever thing. Is there a scientific explanation or is it one of those things that just happen? And I went to a lecture on dark energy the other night and it was just so exciting and the guy said something really clever. I'm going to get you ready for it now, Tim? You're listening carefully?
Yeah.
Okay. The universe is under no obligation to make any sense. Comma.
Right.
But scientists are. So there is a reason, but we don't know it. So with regard to déjà vu, theory number one was that you've got your left and right brains. They're quite independent of each other. They're joined by a very little narrow bundle. And by the way, this bundle is bigger in women than in men, and therefore women should be running the country rather than, and in fact, the world, because they've got a better ways of getting a decision out of not enough input. So you've got two separate brains, and I'm thinking, oh, maybe the signal comes into one brain slightly differently from the other. As an example of this, if you get a baby, a newborn baby, and examine the baby as a doctor or a nurse, and then deliberately as an experiment, hand the baby back to the mother on the centre line, 90% of the time they'll swivel a baby around so they're holding the baby with their left hand.
Right.
And if they're left-handed, they'll say, I'm holding with my left hand because my left hand is stronger. And if they're right-handed, they'll say, I'm holding it with my left hand because my right hand is stronger and I can use my right hand to do something else.
Yep.
So the point is that your brain, your left and right brain process information differently. Your left and right nostrils smell differently. Your left and right ears hear differently, put different emotional status. So they're thinking, okay, the information goes into the left brain and the right brain differently, is slowed down, and then you're getting it mismatched. Do I hear it just a fraction of a second ago or not? That was, they used to believe that theory until they came across people who had no connection between the left and right brain, either as a result of birth or surgery, and some of these people still had deja vu. Okay,
right.
That theory's out the window. Another theory, you're seeing stuff in the outside world, and it takes a 0.3 of a second, a third of a second, to turn it into this full wraparound thing that we call colour, stereo, wall-to-wall vision. But there's a little signal that's fed off looking for emergencies, like a car coming at high speed around a corner or a killer kangaroo. And so before it gets into this full wraparound vision, you've got this low-resolution signal being fed into your system, a low-resolution signal. And they're thinking, well, and immediately it's looked at, it's checked for danger and it's thrown away. And they're saying, well, maybe this one leaks into the system, you know, the knowledge of it. Okay, there are people who are totally blind who have deja vu.
Yes.
So the answer at the moment is we've got a bunch of theories. We know it's real. We don't know why.
Good question, Tim. Thanks for the call.
All right, cheers for that.
See you later. Mick in Adelaide's got a question kind of in the similar vein. Hello, Mick.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I was just wondering, my son writes with his left hand and kicks balls with his right foot.
Ah.
So okay, he's ambidextrous?
Yeah. Yes and no. Ambidextrous is like trying to put a label on something. Is pink pink, or is it deep fuchsia, or is it light red, or whatever it is? It is what it is, and we're just trying to put a label on it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's useful to putting a label on, and sometimes you push it too far and it doesn't count anymore.
Right.
So with regard to the right-hand and left-hand thing, if you look at right-handed, right-footed, right-eyed, and right-something else, it goes right-eared, it goes 90, 80, 70, 60% of the population. And believe it or not, you're probably one-eyed or the other-eyed. There's a 90% chance that you're right-handed. But if you look at two sticks lining up, just you know, somewhere, or two things lined up, and then put your hand across one eye and then put your hand across the other eye, and then that'll tell you which is your dominant eye. So you're not using both your eyes to line up those sticks, you're using one eye. You see, so go on.
The thing there is, he's actually legally blind in his right eye.
Oh,
yeah.
Did you hear that?
Yeah,
that was out of field.
Yeah, so that's what makes me think, what's exactly going on? Obviously, one side of the brain controls one half the body, etc. And then with him being legally blind in his right eye, but yeah, he kicks right-footed and writes left-handed.
Okay, now the one of the top scientists on this is a guy called Ona Göttingen, who was the guy who worked out that birds use one eye looking for food and the other eye to look for danger. And he was the guy who wrote a fairly obscure paper called Persistence of Adult Head-Turning Asymmetry.
Right.
I think, what the heck is that about? And he's referring to the fact that when babies are born, for 1 month before they're born and 1 month after they're born, you give them a bit of a noise or a shock or a call, and they'll turn their head to the right.
Right.
An adult persistence of this, so that's your head-turning asymmetry, an adult persistence of this head-turning asymmetry refers to the fact that when people move in for the kiss, they tip their head to the right.
Yeah.
Now, two-thirds of people tip their head to the right, one-third of people tip their head to the left. And this is a major failure with our education system. Because 4 out of 9 people are both right turners and they will get a kiss off satisfactorily. In 1 out of 9 cases, you got 2 left turners coming together and they will be able to kiss satisfactorily. 4 yep. out of every 9 times you got a right turner or a left turner situation happening, they'll bang their heads together, and we're dealing with people who are the most fragile in our society. I'm talking about the youth of Australia who are, and they don't know it, they are at their most beautiful and manly, as if they're male and female and handsome. They're just gorgeous, the young people, and yet they're at that time of their life when they are most fragile and insecure. What
fail.
Is the education system doing about the fact that 4 out of every 9 times when they're moving in for their kiss, they hit their foreheads together? I think it should go right to Julia Gillard, right to the top.
I like that we've wound up this question in this way. Thanks for the call, Mick.
No worries. Thanks a lot.
See you later. Gavin in Brisbane. Hello.
Hello, Dr.
Good
Gavin.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
Dr. Carl, I've got a problem with bird poo on my kid's trampoline.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, my kids have got one of those enclosed trampolines with the netting that goes right around it.
So that when they fall, they don't hit themselves on the head or other soft body parts.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, there's this bird that I've never seen that must come along and sit on top of the netting, okay, and it poos on the trampoline mat in exactly the same spot again and again and again. I clean it all off, we come back a week later, and it's piled up again. It's the size of a roundabout.
Wow.
So my question is, why is the bird doing it, okay, and how do I stop it from doing it?
I can answer the second one more easily. You can now go to your favourite hardware store and buy little spikes that are married to a plastic rail, and they can be metal spikes or plastic spikes, and they've got double-sided sticky tape. And you put this along, for example, you might have a pipe going high up inside a building and the birds might fly in the building, sit on the pipe and then poo. And what the spikes do is make it extremely uncomfortable for the bird to land.
So you can buy
these spiky things, and if you get the ones made out of plastic, if the kids happen to touch them, then it won't hurt their hands, but it's annoying enough to stop the bird from doing it. As to why the bird does it, I have no idea, but go to drkarl.com, drkarl.com, and then you'll see a Twitter feed. Zip down the bottom and give your answers on the Twitter feed, or go to the Triple J site, which is...
triplej.net.au. Keep an eye. We'll hopefully get an answer for you. Thanks for the call, Gavin.
Okay, thank you.
See you later. At the start of the hour, we did have Luke in Wollongong, who dropped off with his fart question, but thank God he's back. Hello, Luke.
Hello.
What's your question?
When I was younger, I would have been 12 or 13, but it's been bothering me now for 15 years. I thought I saw a mate. When he farted, I thought I saw a shadow. And ever since, I've been trying to, you know, replicate the situation or thereabouts. And I was wondering if Dr. Carl could conceive of a situation wherein a fart could cast a shadow.
Good question.
Well, first thing to realise that it's not just terrorists that fart, but regular people do it about 13, 14 times a day with a total volume of about half a litre.
Right.
Secondly, thanks to the ministrations of Triple J, we have succeeded, you, I, the Triple J audience, in developing the world's first fartographs based on a question by a nurse who said, if I fart in an operating theatre, will I contaminate the theatre?
Mm.
Whereupon some people in Canberra, thank you, Luke, actually did fartographs where they got their child to fart on a culture plate and proved that there was both the initial blast zone, as they called it, where you had fecal bacteria. The blast zone, together with the splatter ring where you had skin bacteria laid on it. And there's a picture of one of these on one of my books, and you can get it for free on the internet. But to answer your question, I'm thinking that there would have been some waviness, there would have been a unique set of conditions so that you could have seen the fart. Was this person fully clothed? Were they wearing swimming cosies, or were they wearing many layers of clothing?
We were at school, it was lunchtime, and it was a clear day. He was wearing shorts, and I'm told underpants underneath those shorts.
Okay, because what happens is that both the underpants and the other clothing above the underpants would have filtered, would have reduced the air coming through. It could well be that the particular combination of fabrics and hole sizes matching up and so forth with the fabric of the underpants and the shorts could have enhanced it or not. I don't know enough about the turbulence. One way to always see farts actually see them is to use a technique, now forgive my spelling, Schlerien, S-C-H-L-E-R-I-E-N, or something like that. But if you look that up in Wikipedia, you'll be able to see something about it. I am looking towards this being our new Ig Nobel Prize. You have started us off on this one there, the fart thing. Normally, it's not possible. I'm impressed by the fact you're able to see it. It's a hard topic to be able to reproduce it. I think we should start some research on this.
And thank you for inviting Carl to use the phrase blast zone as well when talking about farts. Luke?
If I may, I'll just for anybody who comes up with a hypothesis that he had a dusty bottom, we checked that and it wasn't dust coming from his shorts that we could see.
You checked. Oh, so very good. All right, well, keep us posted and we'll see how those Ig Nobel Prizes go, Dr. Carl. Thanks for the call, Luke.
Thank you, Luke.
Dave is in Adelaide today where the temperature is rising. Good morning, Dave.
How are you doing?
Pretty good, but how are you? How hot is it at the moment?
Oh, I couldn't tell you right now, but it's definitely on its way to 43.
Jeez.
43?
43 today, yeah.
Now, was there something about it being the only catastrophic fire safety words used?
Well, I had a cousin on his way back to Lincoln. G'day, Ryan. And on his way back, he sent me a message saying, you know, it's all closed down at Port Augusta and catastrophic fire zone. So, yeah, it's a bit of a hectic.
Catastrophic fire zone is the phrase. It hasn't been used before. This is really serious
stuff. It is a pretty intense thing. There is a total fire ban today in most parts of southeastern Australia, through South Australia, Victoria and New South Wales. You've actually got a question about the hot weather, though, today, Dave. What's your question?
My question is, a long time ago I was told a nice hot tea is the best way to cool yourself down in the hot weather. Do you have anything to say in regards to that?
My mum also thinks this. Is it true, Dr. Carl? It seems silly to me.
I don't know. On one hand, I can see arguments for it, and I can also see arguments against it. One argument against it is that you have a body, and the body has a certain amount of heat in it. You're putting out heat at 100 watts. You throw some more heat into that, you know, container that is your body. Whoa, you're going to get more uncomfortable. But it's not a passive box, it's an active box. It could well be that the tea encourages some sort of vasodilation or sweating, some sort of mechanism like that to help you cool down more rapidly. I don't know. If somebody could send us a link to a peer-reviewed paper on this, either via Triple J or by the Twitter, Dr. Carl, or go via drcarl.com, I'd be very grateful. I think there's something in it, Zan, because it's part of the common belief system, and often the common belief system has got a lot going for it. By common, I mean the shared belief
system. If enough people believe it,
Well, not always, but sometimes, you know. Okay. I think there's something here.
Hey, thanks for the call, Dave.
Cheers.
See you later. Patricia in Roeville, good morning.
Good morning. How are you all?
Very well. What's your question?
My question is, I eat apples. I love my fruit. And for a little while, I used to buy a few apples, both green and red ones, and I used to just leave them there. And over time, the green ones would go off, but the red ones wouldn't. They'd just start shrinking. So then I kind of started thinking, when will they ever go off? So I grabbed a few and I decided to do a bit of an experiment and I put them on the windowsill and it's been 5 months and they haven't gone off. They've just shriveled up and they look disgusting. And then I'm asking, why don't they go off and what is it? Have they been tempered with and what is it that we're eating then? Because I don't eat red apples now.
Well, look, I think this is wonderful. It'd be absolutely glorious that you've done this experiment, and I really hope that the Triple J budget can send you a fund back, a pack of any crap that they've got lying on the desk around the place. The green apple was invented by Granny Smith, whose remains are in St Anne's Church on Victoria Road in Ryde in New South Wales.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking that the apple skin has a job of being able to interact with the environment by letting water vapour go in and out and keep bacteria in.
Uh-huh.
And keep bacteria out. Got that wrong.
Right.
So the red apple is able to do that water vapour thing and it stops bacteria from getting in. The green apple is not doing so. What's going on? Is it something inherent in the property of the recently developed, only a century and a half ago, green apple? Or is it that they have come from a different part of the country where the apple skins are naturally different and are more open to letting bacteria in? Or is it that all green apples
will eventually let bacteria in, whereas red apple skins won't? Or is it part of the chemical processing system whereby they've been sprayed with something, waxed with something, had a sticky label stuck on them? You know, all that sort of crap that can go on that you don't know. The answer is I don't know, but you've raised a really good question. There is that I reckon that the physiological difference is that water vapor can go in and out of both of them, but bacteria cannot get into your red apple. So you have to do the experiment again, and this time I'd like you to take a photograph every day from a camera that's on a tripod so you can turn it into a movie and show it on YouTube, maybe have some more mournful goth music playing in the background, I don't know, something like that. Okay, maybe some happy music as well, and then try different red apples. Now, it's taking you how many months to do this?
5 months.
Patricia, you deserve a Triple J fun pack.
Stay on the line, Patricia. We'll get your details and see what we can, well, scramble around the office and find for you today.
Great. Thank you very much.
Good on you, mate. Dr. Carl's joining us here on Triple J. Marcus from Orange called up to say that the fart shadow was probably the bending of the light due to the hot air released by the fart. Thoughts, Dr. Carl?
Absolutely correct. Why was I going for something really complicated, except for the fact that Luke said he's tried to observe farts since then and has never seen it? But that's the point. Maybe it was a cold day and the warm air coming out would bend the light. That makes perfect sense.
Thanks for the call, Marcus. We're talking science today and also getting some answers. Hamish from Mosman has got one for us. Hi, Hamish.
Yo, hi.
Hi. We were just talking before that song about the theory that if you drink hot tea on a hot day, then it cools you down. What do you think?
Yeah, well, Dr. Carl was saying there's reasons for and against, but it's because, like, I've heard that it's actually because when you're drinking hot tea, your body's obviously overheating, so it reacts to, you know, sweat or whatever to cool it down. So, like, a lot of people in India, I believe, drink tea to do this when it gets really hot there. So, I believe it acts to your body to cool it down. So
the pores open up, you sweat a bit more, and when you sweat, that cools you down. What do you reckon,
Carl?
That's
right.
I think that they do it in India. I've seen them do it. And I think that might be the reason, and I'm hanging out for a peer-reviewed paper. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Hamish.
Cheers.
See you later. Graham in Layla, hello.
G'day, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
When you're traumatised, like the breakup of a relationship or something like that, and you go off your food, is that produced by a chemical reaction?
Good question.
Or anything where you go from the brain to the body is hard. I remember I had a particularly painful breakup one time where this girl broke up with me after I'd been in New York doing research for a while. And the terrible thing was that I had all these offers from these really attractive American women who wanted a relationship with an Australian cute guy, which I was at that time, who was going to go away really quickly. And there were all these offers, and she waited until I came back because she didn't want to break my heart while I was overseas. And so when I came back, I had a broken heart and no offers. And so I found myself going off my diet and then doing lots of exercise and running and everything. And I reckon there is something. The short term, definitely the adrenaline goes up. That stops you from eating. Longer term, I've got no idea of what hormones and chemicals would be involved, but I know there's something real. It's typical. It's in the literature that people will pine away, wasting off their loved one. The names of the chemicals, don't know.
But in terms of that short term, is it the adrenaline that's released, the shock to the system, the adrenaline that's released that kills your appetite? Is that what it is?
That's for the first hour or two or three.
Oh, okay, but not for days or a week or whatever.
Not for days on. And there's something else going on. And if somebody could tell us, drcarl.com or the Triple J site, Twitter away, give us the answer, that'd be lovely.
Thanks for the call, Graham.
No problem.
See you later. Jared in Maroubra, hello.
Hey, I'm just wondering why people's accents vary from place to place.
Ooh.
It seems to be that we're kept in line by the people around us. The natural size of a group is about 120. And you see this in military platoons, in church groups, where you have the sorts of churches where the people are kept in line by each individual church. And when they get to around 120 or so, they then split up into two smaller churches so they can keep people in line by social pressure. And the number of people that you're really close to in your phone book, 120, all that sort of stuff. And once you get above that, people begin to diverge. Now, that's a really weak, sloppy answer. And I read this in a journal called The Sciences, and it was by a professor of linguistics who just retired, and he said it was something along those lines. It's simply we're kept in line by the people around us. Once you're away from the people around you, you can start to diverge, add two centuries, and you'll follow what somebody else is doing, which is why, for example, many people speak in Australian but sing in American because of that cultural pressure that America is, like it or not, a cultural leader in this field, in the world, for English-speaking languages, which Australia adheres to. So that's a fairly weak theory, Dr. Jared.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jared. David in Canberra, hello.
G'day, doctors. How are you going?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
I was wondering about the possibility if Earth was hollow and we drilled a hole through the crust to the inside, would the gravitational effect of the Earth allow us to walk around on the inside of the crust, or would we fall through to the centre?
Mm.
Number one, it was Gauss, that really smart guy who as a kid was asked to add up the numbers from 1 to 100 and did so in about 2 seconds. Mm. You know the trick for that, Zan?
No.
What you do is you think about the numbers 1 to 100 and you look at the ones right at the very end. Well, 1 plus 100, that's 101.
Mm.
And then you look at the next two, 2 and 99, well, they add up to 101. And blow me down, 3 and, you know, you got 50 such pairs that add up to 101. Well, 50 by 101, well, 50 is 5,050. So Gauss was given this as a 7-year-old kid and immediately he put his hand up saying, please, sir, the answer is 5,050. He was a genius. Anyhow, he was the guy who proved that you can treat a gravitational body like the Earth as a point with all of the mass concentrated at the centre. So, on one hand, the gravity is sucking you towards the centre. Whatever mass there is, even if it's in a hollow shell, imagine you've got a hollow shell, say 2 kilometres thick, 1 kilometre thick, whatever it is, and nothing else, it still behaves as though the gravity is at the centre, right, as though the mass is at the centre. So, if you're on the inside of that very thin shell, which has a diameter of 12,000 kilometres, but a wall thickness of only 1 or 2, it still behaves as though whatever mass there is sucking you. So there'll be a weak amount of suck towards the center and a weak amount of centrifugal throwing out. They don't like that word in physics, centrifugal, at the equator. On the Earth as it is at the moment, this centrifugal throwout reduces your mass at your weight at the equator by about 0.5% as compared to the pole. So, yes, you could get stuck on the inside. If the Earth was spinning fast enough and the shell was strong enough and if the mass was low enough, you could get stuck on the inside of the shell under those circumstances.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, David.
Thank you, David.
Claire's calling in from Cheltenham this morning. Hi, Claire.
Good morning, doctors.
Good morning. What's your question?
Well, this has been bugging me for years, so I've done a little experiment lately. I've been safely taking my hands off the wheel of my car. I've got a 2002 Hyundai Accent, and the steering wheel always, always veers to the left. And my theory is that because we drive on the left-hand side of the road, that they've made it that way so that we'll safely collide with the side of the road and not the other side where the cars are coming.
Ah. This reminds me of the night I smashed up 6 taxis.
Jeez.
It wasn't my fault. I'll talk about another time.
Yes.
But I went into the taxi base the next day and Ron, the taxi boss, said, "Here comes Nikki," shouting out really loudly. By the way, I don't know if you know about this, but taxis are sort of like your real 1930s working class depression thing, where if you're not a regular driver, you turn up and if the boss likes you, you get a taxi, and if not, you go home and you don't get any money.
Mm.
And I was living this life for many years. And he said, "Here comes Nicky," couldn't pronounce Krushelnitsky, "and he smashed up 6 cars last night and he thinks he's going to get another taxi tonight." Everybody thought this was really funny and laughed drolly, and also it meant that they would get a taxi. I said, "Yeah, Ron, I want a taxi." He said, "You smashed up 6 cars last night." I said, "It wasn't my fault." He said, "Okay, fill out the paperwork." So I came back the next night and the next night and the next night, and he wouldn't give me a car. And finally, after about 3 weeks of coming back, he said, "Okay, Nicky, take William." And of course, you know, William is William the Conqueror, so it was taxi plate 1066 in New South Wales. Okay?
Yes.
So I went upstairs to get Nicky, to get William the Conqueror, 1066. And the mechanic said, "Oh, I haven't really finished." I said, "Mate, I'm really broke. I haven't got any dough." He says, "Oh, all right, take it. Might have a bit of trouble with the brakes and the steering." Well, I got this taxi. I started driving it, and as soon as I started driving it, there was this ramp. So I had to, you know, hold the wheel really firmly one side to go down the ramp, and so I went down this twisty spiral ramp. As soon as I got on the road, and the car immediately it was really obvious that it was pulling really badly to the right.
Mm-hmm.
So I put on the brakes, and immediately it started pulling really badly to the left. And I made my way sort of working out how to drive this beast of a car. So whenever I had my hands on the wheel, I had to pull one way. Whenever I went the other way, yeah, all that sort of stuff. And yep. I got to the taxi stand, and these 4 guys said, "Quick, take us to the airport." I said, "Right, hop in." Passenger door front wouldn't open. Passenger door back wouldn't open. boot wouldn't open. They all had to get on the driver's side rear, and that's how I drove through the night. So if your car is pulling to, and the other side of the coin is when I was a car mechanic, I was working on my Chevrolet firstly, I was able to set it up so I could drive at 150 Ks and take my hands off the wheel and it would drive down the road true as a die if the road was flat.
Wow.
So if your car is pulling to one side, what I suggest you do is you get your, when you don't mind getting your hands dirty, walk out to the car and run your hands over the front tyres. Now, run them over the back tyres first.
Okay.
The back tyres will be running true. And what you'll feel is, you know, bump, you know, mountain, bump, mountain, bump, mountain. And then, one at a time, run your hands over the front tyre. And you'll feel that you've got the bump, mountain, bump thing, but they're ridged. They're not flat. They're actually like little peaks of a wave. It goes up at an angle and sudden drop, up at an angle and sudden drop.
Yep.
And you'll probably feel that on each of your tyres, and then your hands will be dirty and you have to wash your hands. And then you'll go to your tyre place and you'll say, can you set up the steering? And then can you adjust the brakes after that? Almost certainly the brakes won't need adjustment because they're disc brakes, but it's important that you get this set up properly because you're wearing your tyres out, and it's also a safety hazard if you have to put on the brakes hard and it's slightly wet and the wheels start to skid and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But do the experiment just for fun with your hands.
Okay.
And prepare the fact you're going to have to wash your hands afterwards. Test out the back tyres first, then the front tyres, and then you'll feel these little ridgy things at an angle, like little waves. And mm-hmm. if you can feel that, your tyres are worn and you probably have to get new tyres as well.
And keep your hands on the wheel, Claire.
And keep your hands on the wheel.
I will. And Dr. Carl, you're my silver fox. I just wanted to tell you that.
Jeez. Kidding on Dr. Carl.
Whoa.
I'm in love with your brain. My husband's a bit jealous, but yeah.
Is Dr. Carl your free ticket? You know how marriages generally have that free ticket if there's a chance? Is he your free ticket, Claire? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Look out!
Now, what's a female equivalent to a silver fox? Is it
a
cougar?
I guess
a
cougar.
Is that Demi Moore and her younger
husband? Silver foxes, you know, it's specifically men with silver hair.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
So, in fact, women should marry men or be with men younger than them because that way you match the sexual desires and the age of death so the women don't have to spend the last few years of their life being alone.
Right.
Thanks for the call, Claire.
No worries.
We've made a few social observations there. Sorry,
really
Claire.
Have, and maybe a date as well. Dr. Carl, you had an answer on Twitter.
I have lots of answers with regard to cooling down on hot days. The Indians not only believe in the tea, they believe in the hot curry cooling you down. Thank you, Mr. Wolfie.
Mm.
And blow me down, I reckon there's something in it. Don't know the exact mechanism. Maybe somebody will be able to give us that one. Secondly, with regard to the car pulling over to the side of the road, roads are cambered, and that means that they're raised in the centre. And that's so that the water will fall off to one side. And you should compensate for that slightly. But then sometimes you've got a road which is heavily cambered, sometimes lightly cambered. It's a difficult one to go for. Now, what have we got coming in for questions?
Okay. Joe in Newcastle. Hello.
Hey, guys. How you going?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
Well, I was just wondering, I've had this happen to me a few times. It's usually when I'm listening to music, I'll get chills down the right side of my body but not down the left. And it happened to me again the other night while I was watching Doctor Who, so I thought I should probably ring the doctor.
You are absolutely correct. You've got two separate sides of your body and they're wired differently. And it's only by hard work, by a very small bundle of fibres, the corpus callosum, which has only 1 million fibres, that joins 10 trillion fibres on one side to 10 trillion on the other.
Okay.
And in my particular case, what I remember is in my early days on TV, doing live TV, I would get very nervous.
Yeah.
My left armpit, is that right? No, my left armpit would get very cold and my left armpit would sweat like crazy, like a bucket. It was really obvious. And so my left hand would be really, really cold because it was my left brain that was trying to be all intellectual.
Okay.
And this went on for several years and then gradually it wound down, but I still have a little bit of, there's definitely a left-right asymmetry. And if I, normally before a gig, I touch my hands to my face, as well as do various superstitious, non-scientific things. I don't say, good luck before a show or else you've ruined it. I've got to say, break a leg. And also, don't ever mention the Scottish play. And then, one time I was at the midday show with Ray Martin and there was this woman on who was a belly dancer.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, Dr. Carl, I'm so nervous. I said, oh, my God, please, can I feel your hands? Her right hand was freezing. And I said, how about your right armpit? And she said, I'm sweating like a hose, but my left armpit is not. So she was using the other side of her brain. So what you are seeing is an example of the left-right dichotomy in humans. Which side of your body gets the chills, left or right?
The right side.
It's the right side, which is your emotional side.
Ah, that makes sense.
Now, if you go and train musically and learn lots of musical phrase like anacrusis and so forth, and then you start hearing some of that, like in our wonderful various songs that are around the place, you will then see the other side of your brain going when you hear some very good musical techniques going on. So you are being a regular human being.
Awesome.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Good on you for being regular. Tristan in Singleton, hello.
G'day, how you doing?
Good. What's your question?
I was wondering, when I send an email, let's say I send you guys an email, it's no longer on my computer. Is it on your computer? Or if you can access that email from another computer, like a third computer, whereabouts is the email in the meantime?
That is the beauty of the internet. Roy Baran, in the late 1950s, tried to come up with this idea of providing good connectivity. Back then it was the Cold War, and it was working on a threat. It was mutually assured destruction. You touch me, said the Soviets or the Americans, with one nuclear weapon, and I'll put all 25,000 of my nuclear weapons on you. Each side said that to each other. And it depended on having good communication so that you could launch all your 25,000 nuclear weapons. And Roy Baran knew, working for the RAND Institute, that the communications were not that good. Every time they did a test, the vast majority of them went down. You know, simulation. So he came up with the idea that led to the internet. Number one, have not just a central hub and spoke system, like you might have one centre in, say, Perth and another one in Sydney, and everything goes out from that. And if you destroy, say, Perth and Sydney, then you lose all your communications. No, have many hubs and spokes. Think of it like chicken wire over the whole network. And wherever two wires cross, that is a hub. Each of those is a server. And secondly, break the message down into little packets. So if you're sending your message from, say, Perth to Sydney, some of it might go via Darwin. Some of it might go via Hobart. Some might go via Japan. And all you're saying is bomb the heck out of the old Soviet Union. It's just a simple five-word message. And the beauty of it is that it's very robust. If it doesn't get through this way, it'll get through that way. And there are servers all the way along the line. And each packet of the message has a bit of the word like bomb, and then it says, I'm supposed to end up in Sydney, and this is where I came from. And so they're all being sent out, and they're stored at servers along the way. And the beauty of it is that it'll always work. It's very strong. It'll slow down, but it'll always work. The disadvantage is that the American military couldn't understand it, so they didn't want to have it. It was then used by various universities so they could use expensive computer time. This is when computers used to be really, really expensive. Mm. And then finally, it turned into the stuff that you and I use all the time. So it's being stored in little servers all along the way. And as soon as a message has been sent to another server and has got a response back that's been picked up by that next server, then it's lost off the first server.
Oh, okay.
That makes sense, Tristan?
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense.
Thanks. Awesome. Thanks for the call. Speaking of that wonderful thing, the internet, if you ever miss out on any of Dr. Carl on Thursdays, you can, of course, download the podcast, triplej.net.au. It's up there every week. And we will catch you next week after 11, Dr. Carl.
Thank you very much. Peachy Keen.